Exactly. Yeah, exactly. All right. Good job, Jim. All right, so I'm going to change speeds a little bit and get back to some bread and butter emergency medicine. And that is looking at a visual diagnosis of pediatric patients, focusing on rashes, if I can ever get this up. There we go. I think that one's it. Okay, got the right clicker, got the mic on, we're all ready to go. So definitely changing speed a little bit. Thought I had the right clicker. There we go. So first of all, I just want to start with vocabulary, because how we describe rashes, especially to our dermatology consultants, is really important. Really what I focus on is the link between a papule and a nodule, right? An immacule and a plaque. So a papule, definitely something you can palpate that's raised, usually less than a half a centimeter, and a nodule is a big papule. A macule, usually something you can't feel, typically less than a centimeter, and a plaque, if you can't feel it and it's not scaly, is a big macule. Then you can just go on from there. We have a pustule, is a papule filled of pus. A vesicle is a papule filled of fluid. A wheal is kind of that in-between thing we look at, and then a fissure and cyst are really pretty easy. So just kind of a quick review of vocabulary for rashes when you write it in your chart. So this is all going to be case-based, though. So we're going to start with a case. A one-year-old male comes into the emergency department with fussiness, multiple pruritic papules. He's itching like crazy. No history of fever, and the siblings have similar lesions. So the first thing you do, most of us start itching the minute we read that chief complaint. Grab your gloves, go in the room, and this is what you see. You see some kind of erythematous papules, belly area, and neck. Anybody have an idea what this is? Itching, siblings have it. Chickenpox would be one. Scabies, and that's what this is. Scabies. When you think about scabies, think about, look at your hands and your feet. And the kind of waistline of your classic locations, you can see some linear burrows with some papules on the feet. Symmetric linear red papules you'll see on the hands, and you can see it here in the neck. You can sometimes get pustules also. You can actually also get kind of grouping of it that can get red, escoriated lesions that are papules, so you can get some kind of macerated vesicles that they break off. And then classically, the web spaces of the hands. So if you see somebody and says, my hands are really itching, all of us start thinking, I mean, scabies is one of those things on the top of your list. So when I was at Davis about 5 years ago and I left there, we had a great pediatrician, a pediatric emergency physician, who kind of said, look, I have five differentials for itchy rashes. I have eczema or atopic dermatitis. I have eczema, atopic dermatitis, scabies, chickenpox, and contact dermatitis. Those are her kind of big five for itchy rashes. And I think if you can keep those in mind, you get most of them. The good thing is itchy rashes usually are not life-threatening. So in your sick or not sick, itchy rashes when they come in, except for more severe chickenpox as it gets more disseminated varicella, they aren't life-threatening. They are, however, extremely contagious, especially the chickenpox and the scabies. So what do you do if you have somebody come in, and what are we looking for? This is that little bugger of a mite that you see, and you've got to get rid of them. They're highly contagious. It's spread by skin-to-skin contact. Burrows are pathognomonic, web spaces, really, I'm a nocturnist. They come in at night. And they're brought in at night because they can't sleep, the kids, and the parents can't sleep. And so at that point, it's decided to go in the emergency department. You treat it with permethrin, malathione, or chromatone. Usually, remember to use in kids, try to stay away from the alcoholic preparations because it can sting if they've got some excoriations. Repeat treatment in a week if it isn't better, and treat everybody. On these cases, if somebody comes in and they're an infant, I give them a tube that should fit a high school basketball team. And I say, treat everyone, boil your clothes, watch them in as high a temperature you can because of the how contagious this is. All right, next case. A 10-year-old girl reports itching that's been recently become relentless and results in sleep loss. Somehow my picture didn't try it, but this is what it is. And this is atopic dermatitis. I mentioned my rashes. Scabies for itching, atopic dermatitis. On these, on her especially, you can see this area that is a little raised, feels like a little bit like sandpaper. The challenge with atopic dermatitis is it's not really one size fits all. So this, one of the things you can look at and how you can describe it is lignified follicular papules. Those are small papules, feel like sandpaper, on an area that looks like it's more chronic. And that's what that lignification is. It's that thickening of the skin that you see. But it also can appear as more of an erythematous scaly plaque. Typically, you'll see those in the neck area. You'll also see those on your flexor surfaces, and I'll show you that in a minute. You can see some actually blanching follicular papules, especially the darker the skin. And then your extensor surfaces where you get some lignified scaly red plaques. Now, I never go on for a couple more cases. On kids, look for cheeks. And then we'll go over to management of this. This is the one that I miss the most. Anybody seen this recently? These are annular atopic dermatitis, and these are circular plaques that actually are edematous and red. They do blanch, but this is one of the more uncommon presentations, usually presents in adults, though. So adults with atopic dermatitis may present like this, and it actually is one of those kind of rashes that you're like, huh, because it doesn't look like typical atopic dermatitis. So treatments. One of the things for treatments are there's no quick fix. The treatments for this largely are twofold. One, H2 blockers, or Benadryl anti-itch agents such as that, and the second, steroids. This actually is a relatively large problem in kids who get it, and majority of the time they're going to come in because they can't sleep. Matter of fact, there's some studies done looking at children with atopic dermatitis. And actually, if not treated and they don't get under control, they actually do have increased learning deficits because of the inability to stay awake, difficulty sleeping. And so parents who will come in are really going to be asking for two things. I need my kid to sleep because we all got to go to school tomorrow. And that actually can extend up to the teenage years. The most common times to get the diagnosis of atopic dermatitis is actually in the toddler ages. So that's really between, it peaks about 1 to 2, but about 20% will persist into the adolescent age. There is no great randomized trials on how to treat this. There has been some studies that look at this patient should be on long-term maintenance steroids or burst, depending on when they have their exacerbation. My guess, if they're coming to us in the emergency department, it's acute event, they're gonna want a burst. We typically say use the less potent steroids on the face, higher potency in the body. Not great data on why. That's just what I was always taught. So, and that's what I don't think there's ever been a randomized trial to say that it does affect the skin, but that is classic teaching. The ones I remember all the time is I remember triamcinolone, and I recommend betamethasone, and those are kind of my go-to ones for treatment of atopic dermatitis. I will, if the issue is they're coming at night, recommend Benadryl for sleep. Clearly, that's not in the young kids, but if they're the adolescents and stuff, that usually is the reason why they're there. They've usually adapted to the ability to have these rashes, but they just can't sleep, so I'll add that on to help them through it. Otherwise, not much great info on this, on the prevention of this. They're trying new things, but the actual how it's managed is not really clear as far as evidence-based. All right, here's three different kiddos, three different rashes. You have this one. She's got some kind of scaly, a little bit crusted lesions. There's some open sores around her mouth, her nose. This one has more like punctate lesions that you see along the mouth, up extending to the nares. And this one's got a little bit more disseminated rash on his face, some raised, some vesicles, some punctate, and a little bit more over the body. Anybody have any ideas what this one is? All right. Let's see. That one is impetigo. All right. Classically, that Staph aureus or strep pyogenes can lead to streptococcal glomerulonephritis, that association just like you see with strep throat. Typically, you'll see ruptured vesicles with some honey-colored crusting. And actually, the honey-colored crusting is the more pathognomonic thing associated with impetigo in general. More common in kids with pre-existing skin conditions. So these kids may have a history of atopic dermatitis. It is very contagious. Rapid spreading usually begins around the mouth. Mild cases, go ahead and you can have gently scrub and have the parents remove the crusting and treat with mupirocin. Moderate cases, you can give anti-staphylococcal penicillins, augmentin, cephalosporins, or macrolides. The bottom line, however, is, as in all rashes that are really contagious, if your kid has it, the entire nursery school probably has it. Or their kindergarten has it, because that's that age group that gets this. So be sure to inform the patient, the parents about how contagious this is and keep them home. So this is one of those that the parents dread because they have to stay away from school. The middle one is eczema herpeticum. This is an HSV infection. More common, again, in kids with atopic dermatitis. So this is the second kind of vesicular rash associated with that. They can come in with kind of systemic symptoms, fever, lymphadenopathy, malaise. They actually can progress to disseminated infections, and the treatment for this is acyclovir. If severe, you actually may also need to add on treatment for secondary infection. So difference between this kid and the impetigo usually doesn't have that these lesions are clustered, just like you'd expect a herpetic lesion to be. You can see some yellow crusting, but it's more because of the vesicles bursting. But think clustering on the face, HSV-1, especially if they have some history of fever malaise, not acting as normal. The last one is eczema coxsackium, and that's eruption of vesicles and bulli. Usually happens on the hands and feet, but this is what the oral lesions look like. It's an enterovirus, Coxsackie A16, low-potency steroids, wet wraps, usually are all you need to do it, to treat it. So these kids, unlike the other, will have hands and feet lesions, may have some prodromal of illness, but aren't generally as sick. It's the middle ones that are actually sicker. And these will do well on their own. All right. I'm going to give you two kids. And see if you can guess what they each have. This is child A. 5-year-old male, 5 days of fever, 2 days of rash, white spots on his tongue. You see a fine erythematous blanching rash beginning at the axilla and trunk. Right? Kid A. People think? Scarlet fever. All right, that's one. See this one. 2-year-old, 6 days of fever. Increased fussing, also has white spots on the tongue, has a papular rash across the trunk that blanches also. What are you worried about on this one? 6 days of fever or not. So the first one, child A, absolutely right. Scarlet fever, streptococcal pharyngitis with a scarlatiniform rash. Diffuse erythema. Fine papules, kind of sandpapery, and that's what it feels like when you examine them. Starts in the groins and armpits, clinical diagnosis, treatment, strep throat, treat amoxicillin. I'll be honest, if a kid comes in with a rash, kind of red tongue, I don't even treat it for strep. I just start treating it. Child B's Kawasaki's. Diagnostic criteria for that, 5 days of fever plus at least four of the following: conjunctivitis, mucous membrane changes, erythema of the hands or feet with kind of paralingual discomination, rash, and cervicotinopathy. So that child had his mucous membrane changes and a rash. Kawasaki, the treatment usually is 10 days of IVIG to reduce the risk of coronary artery aneurysm, or aspirin until febrile. What I hate about Kawasaki's is there is this bloody diagnosis called incomplete Kawasaki. And I think that's just not fair, right? So this is that kid who comes in and they've got a long fever and may have a rash, maybe a little puny, may have an oral lesion, but just don't hit all of them. On these kids, there's a recommended diagnostic algorithm that really revolves around getting labs. And more importantly, SEDrate CRP. I know for anybody, when I hear the word SEDrate, I cringe because I know that's an extra hour and a half to my life. I'm going to have to take care of this patient, especially in my shop. But in these kids, it can be useful. So you have somebody who you think may or may not have Kawasaki's based on symptoms. So prolonged fever, maybe one of the criteria. If you get a CRP and an ESR, and it's less than 3 or less than 40, depending on kind of where you are and what your local thresholds are, but so lower CRP and ESR, you follow them daily. If the fever continues for 2 days, go back up and reassess to see if they hit the kind of classic algorithm. If the fever resolves and you have desquamation, so as a Kawasaki resolves, that's really when you get your big desquamated rash on the hands and feet. So if the fever resolves, you get your rash, that person, even with a low ESR and CRP, may still have had Kawasaki's, and an echo should be considered. So low ESR, low CRP, fever, deprivesces with a rash, those are the kids you want to make sure, a kind of desquamation, I mean, those are the kids you want to make sure get follow-up. If your CRP and ESR are over 3 or over 40, these labs are supplemental lab criteria. So an albumin, hepatic, your CBC, and a urine. You're going to look for if you have less than three of these abnormal. Go ahead and get your echo, plus or minus, and you're going to repeat it in those patients. So these patients, you're more worried about having it. Bottom line echo, if you have the echo that's positive, you're going to treat. If you have more than three of these labs abnormal, you're going to go ahead and treat them, bring them in for IVIG. So how I break this up, I'm worried, don't classically fit it, I'm going to get an ESR and CRP. If they're normal, the kid looks okay, follow up with their pediatrician, instruct the parents to really look at if they get a rash when the fever goes down, because those patients are going to be higher risk. If they don't look good, and the ESR and CR, if they don't look in general, period, I'm taking them out of the algorithm and bringing them in no matter what. They look okay and their CRP and ESR are high. I've got my supplemental labs to go on because I'm only sticking the kid once, so I'll be honest, if I'm sending labs, I'm sending all of them. If I've got a bunch of them abnormal, go ahead and bring them in for treatment. This group, if I've got a high ESR and CRP, I'm giving an OR to my pediatric specialist. We're all going to be share decision-making with somebody who knows a heck of a lot more about peds and this disease than I am. So these are the patients I'm going to be calling a consultant just to get their input, even if their labs are normal. All right, your next one, purple rash. A 5-year-old female presents to the ED complaining of a purple rash, recent upper respiratory infection, swelling and pain in the ankle, rash on the lower extremity and buttocks. And this is what it looks like. All right? Absolutely. HSP, Heno-Sirloin purpura. Right? Disease of small blood vessels. Typical rash looks like a lot of small bruises. On the lower extremity, they can be raised. What we need to know is the complication of this. I'll be honest, this is not the hardest one to diagnose. But just be aware that it's associated with chronic kidney disease and resulting renal insufficiency. So look for hematuria. They also can come in with GI issues, nausea, vomiting, and arthritis. Pain or joint pain in joints of the abdomen can actually precede the rash. So the rash may come later, and NSAIDs in severe cases, steroids, PO, oral steroids, have been useful, but typically the first treatment is steroids. So that's a little bit different to this one, right? Lower extremities, looks like a lot of bruises, but this one has a couple of things the other didn't. Non-blanching, more pinpoint lesions. And that one is one we can't miss. That's meningococci, right? So much sicker, ill-looking, petechiae rash, usually on the trunk and lower extremities where it begins. How many petechiae correlates with your degree of thrombocytopenia as a result of the meningococcal septicemia, and 15 to 25% go on to purpura fulminans, hemorrhage, and necrosis of the extremities. This is one of the clean kill rashes that we are all worried about missing, and the child who comes in before the rash, and we worry that we haven't, and they develop it afterwards. So these are one of the diagnoses that we most of us fear. Good thing is, vaccines have helped a ton, but this is still one of those kind of pathway to death rashes I worry about significantly. So I have two more kind of areas of cases that we're going to go over, and this is an 18-month-old who comes into the ED with a rash began 2 days ago. Child's healthy except for on amoxicillin for an ear infection. Drug reaction. So there really are kind of three types of drug reactions we deal with. One is we know it can happen. So it's like doxycycline and a phototoxic reaction. Side effects from things like amiodarone, when you get blue-gray skin pigmentation, skin necrosis with doxorubicin's infiltration. Then we have the uncommon and unpredictable reactions, and those are the allergic reactions that we worry about. Reactions to penicillin or anaphylactic-like reactions. And then we have reactions that are idiosyncratic to the drug itself. So the child before had one of the allergic reactions. But as a physician, I can catch those, right? Stop your amoxicillin, let me try something else. The ones I need to get are the ones that are serious. And those are the ones that end up being flown to our burn center at Parkland. And those are going to be broken into a three-component kind of cascade, the first being a drug hypersensitivity reaction. Your common agents for that are your phenytoin, carmazepine, phenobarbital, sulfa drugs, macrolides, nitrofurantoin. Those actually can cause a drug hypersensitivity reaction. Those are erythematous reactions that can become swollen, and the patient's going to become ill-appearing. The next component of drug interactions, though, are the Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Those are mucosal lesions that usually can occur in the conjunctiva, mouth, skin, resulting in less than 10% coverage, same drugs, higher mortality, and last is toxic epidermoid necrosis, erosions at over two sites, over 30% of the body, and these patients have a high risk of death. So Stevens-Johnson and toxic epidermal necrolysis, Stevens-Johnson's two mucosal sites, fever, arthralgia, and malaise, 50% of those are due to drugs. Think penicillin, anticonvulsant, sulfa. The last one I saw was on amoxicillin. Discontinuing is all we can do in supportive therapy. That's it. These usually arrive to our burn center, are admitted and just observed and replaced fluids as they remove the agent. 10 is actually a more erythematous, blistering and exfoliation of skin. That gives you your Nicolesky sign, but morbidity can be up to 50%. These kids usually cannot eat at all because they have such significant mucosal involvement that they're fluids, and these kids look bad. Has anybody seen a kid with 10? They look awful. They're sick, uncomfortable, dehydrated, tachycardic, febrile, and really are, and it really it shows because they have such a high rate of mortality and morbidity. So what about these? What are these rashes of? Use, right? Linear rashes on the lower extremities. Here. Bruising to the ear. Those are classic rashes of abuse, our skin findings of abuse. So cutaneous clues of child abuse. 90% of abuse victims present with lacerations, bruises, and burns. Abusive bruises, any bruise in an infant less than 9 months old. Think abuse. They can't walk. They can crawl, so maybe if they have bruising on their knees, I'd give it there. But any, especially upper extremity bruises, unlikely. Bruises in areas other than bony prominences. Knees, elbows. Mid-thigh bruises. Think are not normal. Bruises on ears, face, abdomen, buttocks, arms, thighs, hands, and feet. Multiple bruises in large clusters, or a single large bruise. And pattern symmetric or bilaterally located bruises, consider child abuse. Now, there always can be good reasons for them, so I'm not saying any bruise in these locations is problematic, but raise your suspicion, especially the younger the child, if you see bruises in non-bony prominences. And with that, any questions? And if not, we'll keep moving to keep on time.